This is Rod Allen.
And I'm John Maida.
And this is Free Range Humans, a place where we consider how to make schools fit for human consumption. Today we're speaking with Shanna Peoples for the second time. And she is the Dr. John G. O'Brien Distinguished Chair in Education at West Texas A&M University. Shanna, welcome back.
Oh, it's wonderful to be back. Thank you.
So today our topic is the intersection of education and politics. Many of the things we've been talking about on the podcast, student-centered learning, 21st century skills, equity, decolonization, making schools more human, are directly under attack as they get linked to broader politics. We have a conservative backlash against gay rights with the Don't Say Gay bill in Florida, and a pushback against an equity agenda, transgendered bathrooms. There are lots of examples of this across the landscape. And so we thought Shanna would be a good person to talk to about this because she has been doing some work along the lines of what I just described in the heart of Texas. And so, Shanna, welcome to the podcast and tell us a little bit about what your experience has been like, either initially as a teacher or now in a university role, trying to do and think about some of these things in a context that's not necessarily favorable to some of the ideas.
Well, thank you both. It's like I said, it's wonderful to get together and talk about these things that typically I'm only talking to myself about in the car on the way to work. So it's nice to have friends to talk it over with. From my perspective, I've always grown up with this sense of, in certainly in Texas, of different kinds of binaries, things that are open to you or that are not open to you, depending on who you are. So just growing up female, you learn from the time you go to the fundamentalist Baptist church that I grew up in, you know, women can't be pastors. And there are very few leadership roles open to women. And to be a woman with any kind of positional power means that you're walking a knife's edge of trying to not be seen as aggressive and not to also be seen as a pushover or fluffy. So, you know, you multiply that when you get at an intersectional personality, you know, that's fine for me to talk about as a white woman. And even as a queer white woman, that's easier for me than if you're a woman of color trying to do that. And so just the nature of who you are is political. In teaching, I think Texas in some ways is late to the party on seeing teaching or schools as political. You know, I try to ask myself, well, then what's changed here? And I think what's changed is you're seeing Republican Party dealing with, at least in Texas, demographic changes that there's no way to ever turn the clock back on. So I think that's, you know, a number one pressure, certainly. And I think that there's a sense of when you're out of ideas or out of policy proposals, the easiest thing to do is to whip up a moral panic. And schools are perceived as this arena where you've already got, you know, it's majority female, so you've got a cultural deference going on with women within schools. And it's seen as this is an easy target. And that's sort of my thumbnail thinking about why schools and why now?
So I agree with a lot of that. I mean, I think it's pretty clear in the broader politics that there is this kind of almost like vicious cycle between the desire for groups that have been historically marginalized to claim a rightful place at the table. I remember a favorite line from the first season of White Lotus where the white dad says, like, when did it become not okay for like white guys to have opinions? And his daughter saying, dad, it's not your time to eat. And like, yes, exactly. And then all the just huge political advantage that can be made by making up out of whole cloth or radically exaggerating threats to white identity and all the things that come with it. I mean, a lot of people made this point, but on critical race theory, I mean, like the most schools were not teaching critical race theory. But before all of this happened, they were just teaching American history, which has race in it. So yeah, so I think there is this sort of like fuel and counterfuel dynamic. So how do you think that one should try to navigate that as a teacher, a principal, someone who's trying to push this work in higher ed?
And that's exactly what the center of the work that I'm doing now is. When they recruited me for this position, I said, you have to allow me to teach a course that specifically deals with race. And I want race in the title. I don't want there to be like any sort of hedging around it and calling it culturally relevant or anything like that. Folks really need to confront this in leadership, because we're in ed leadership, leader preparation program. What I have found is it's interesting how people come into that class with their guard up and ready to just be attacked, which I find just really interesting. And what I have found as far as like success in is having people, you know, this is nothing new. This is nothing that I didn't learn from people who do this much better than I do. But, you know, having people think about their own experience and where they grew up. And it's as simple as one of the first things we do in the class is, you know, draw a picture or draw sort of like a map of the town or the place where you grew up. Now, show me where the bad side of town was and who lived in the bad side of town. And how did you know it was the bad side of town? And what are the stories that you heard about it? What do you notice about the buildings and anything that's around that part of town? And we sort of start from there for them to see these are inherited systems. I think that that is a revelation for many people. I think just the whole concept of redlining is a revelation for many people. We inherently know sundown towns here in Texas. We have some very notorious examples like Vidor, Texas, sundown towns, and certainly noteworthy violence that has happened. But I don't think people connect it to their experience. And then connecting that experience into sort of their pedagogical worldview of, you know, who are the bad kids? So if you grow up knowing that there's a side of town that's bad, it's almost easier to map on, okay, well, this is the group that is intransigent. We can never do anything about these kids, in quotation marks. And folks coming to grips with that is where we're able to start creating bridging conversations of let's talk about what's doable. You know, where among this continuum of behaviors, of moving equity forward where you are, where can you safely join that that keeps you in leadership? Because we need you there. Where do you feel like that's doable? And so by the time they leave the class, they leave with a personalized equity plan of action where they're going to move that forward. And they've identified like allies and partners in the work because, you know, you don't do this stuff by yourself or you really will be a literal target.
Shanna, I'm thinking about the personal safety of classroom educators in a small town, you know, community where everyone's known. Like, how do you balance or talk with teachers about sort of the balance between moving the agenda forward, equity and so on, and helping them maintain their, you know, their personal safety at the same time? Mm-hmm. And I know that's probably a calculus that's slightly different for every individual. But I wonder what your experience has been with folks as they try to balance that out.
Yeah, that's such a good question, Rod. And I think it's different, of course, for different people. And for me, so much of my teaching has exclusively been with populations that don't look like me. And populations that have already, people have sort of given up on. And you presented a different set of problems, which is where you have to openly advocate for investing in those students in those schools and undoing this mindset within students because they've absorbed it, you know, like toxic rain. This idea that this none of this is for you. We have to do this. So one of the things that I really pushed in any leadership role I had in the district was to connect with parents and to have parents as your allies. And I think that you see that even in, for example, Dallas, even in bigger places where the parents that are able to organize each other, the progressive parents or in students, that it's being led that way. It's a matter of them knowing that, okay, you aren't by yourself and there's actually more of you. I mean, we know this from multiple polls. Most people do not want any of these extreme issues that are being put forward. People don't want schools to be where they're censored or like in Texas, where you have a lawmaker, Matt Krause, put out a list of 650 books that he wants pulled off of the shelves. Like, people don't want that. And I think it's a matter of not being afraid to talk about that and teachers to see themselves. This is a lot of the work we do with the Teacher of the Year cohorts, is getting them to see themselves as almost like a lobbyist for kids in their classroom, and it being your role to speak for that group of kids and not being afraid. I alluded to Audre Lorde at the beginning, and it is. I mean, your silence will not protect you, she says, and you're going to be targeted whether you speak or not. So you might as well speak for who you care about.
Powerful. Powerful.
Rod, what does all this look like from Canada? Do you just think that your neighbors to the south have gone off the deep end, or have you faced similar kinds of issues?
Oh, can both be true at the same time? I think so. It seems from north of you that it's so much more heightened down there, and it probably is. I'm sure it is. But I think to Shanna's, you know, recent point, there's sort of a level of rhetoric and there's what most people want. And what most people want is a far more reasonable kind of an approach. It's just trying to find some airtime and a way to get that known and to connect up those people so that they feel connected. And I think that's true here as well. Although I think there's a little more opportunity here at this point in our history in Canada to allow airtime for those reasonable middle group people to have their say and to. There was just a BC Supreme Court, a Court of Appeals decision yesterday. A parent took a local school district to court for infringing on their child's rights around, you know, freedom of religion by requiring students in a class, an elementary school class, to be present when an Indigenous elder smudged the room. Her claim was that's a religious practice and that can't happen. My child wasn't allowed to leave. The courts, and I haven't had a ton of time to go through all that, but one of the quotes from the panel of judges that did not find in favor of the parent. So they said, no, that's not on. And they found for the school district. But I found this interesting, though. One of the justices said, there will often be a tension between a person's absolute freedom on the one hand, and on the other hand, the needs of the community and the rights and freedoms of other people. And so sort of finding on behalf of the group. And the justice went on to sort of say, you know, you've got a historically silenced group of people and there needs to be opportunities and so on for them, and raised the value of multiculturalism. So that's a positive sign, right? That we want to do that. On the other hand, two districts that I know of, and I'm sure there's more, are currently having some fair pushback from parents around how washrooms get gendered in new school buildings. One of them, the school design of this new building, it's a secondary school, has sort of genderless washrooms. They say they're fit for everybody and they're full stalls that are enclosed floor to ceiling and they're to be used by any human being that wants to go in, and they have communal sinks, but, you know, So there's still that level of pushback, but generally speaking, the calm middle ground is still holding on and allowing for people to feel safe to say, actually, I disagree with that loud voice. I think a reasonable approach is, you know, in this case, let's try it, see what happens. It seems like, you know, our kids are good kids. They're all reasonable people. It's what the students want. It's what the educators want. And it makes sense to me. So there's still enough safety for the middle of the road folks to speak an opinion.
I think though, Shannon and I are sitting in university seats and Rod has sat in, you know, government seats of various sorts. I think from the teacher perspective though, you know, we need to acknowledge the absence of formal power in these situations and the ways in which once you broach something in a classroom, you know, it could be a fabulous lesson for 18 out of 19 kids, and the 19th kid could go home and report it to their parent, and their parent could bring it to the school board, and, you know, you could get censored or, in the worst case, fired. And so, you know, there was a survey in October by EdWeek of educators nationwide, more than 1,000 of them, district leaders, principals, and teachers, with a pretty balanced ideological split, 32% liberal, 33% moderate, 35% conservative. And among teachers who had chosen not to address controversial topics in the classroom, a third of them said that they worried about the professional or legal consequences for talking about race, gender, or sexuality. So, Shanna, do you think your Audre Lorde quote applies in those circumstances? Is it easier from the seats that we're sitting in? What do you think?
I think that's an extremely fair question. I think about that often. And it is a way that I, you know, think about the privilege of this position of being able to say things that I couldn't have maybe said. However, you know, there is a part of me that knows I would possibly have been fired 10 times over if I would have been teaching in the K-12 system over the past 2 years. However, that being said, too, in working with teachers who are actively in on campuses, and granted, these are recognized, you know, awarded teachers, we talk about using the privilege of that position, using your informal power and using your soft power and your networks of relationships to, you know, get allies and organize around these ideas. So I think if you as a teacher are thinking that this is something you have to take on by yourself, that's where it can get really scary and that's where it can get silencing. And I think it behooves teachers just in general to organize in whatever way makes sense to them, whether, you know, Texas is a right to work state, so we are not necessarily a union. We have a union, but it doesn't function like it does in, say, New York. But I still think that teachers can come together. You know, it's harder to get rid of two people or three people or four people. And it's much harder to get rid of those people if they're aligned with parents and they're actively creating these relationships with the communities that they serve and opening the doors in whatever ways that they can. I've been fortunate to work with leaders who understood that in their bones and sort of modeled that to me of having the school doors open all the time and having events where we provided food or something for parents to come in and be part of in whatever way they could, what was going on. And I think that lowers the threat and it makes it much harder. You know, when you have it's harder to hate somebody or be afraid of somebody you have a relationship with. So it's just in our best interest as teachers to use and flex the superpower that we have, which is an ability to make relationships and connect quickly with a bunch of different kinds of people.
Is that part of the fear, though, that teachers do have that superpower, the power of relationship? And, you know, after the recent elections down there and, you know, some of the, you know, commentators on the right were saying, you know, they've indoctrinated our kids. That's obviously the problem because young people tend to be voting this way. And therefore, our kids must have been indoctrinated by educators because everybody loves teachers and we have to do something about that. Is that superpower being recognized and starting to be feared and used against teachers?
That is an interesting way to look at it. And I think there's something to it. I think in some ways, just the intimacy of Zoom classes put people or parents, in a sense, in a classroom in a way that isn't normal. I mean, nobody, that is not normal teaching, pandemic teaching, Zoom teaching. But it all of a sudden was discovered by these people as, oh, that's what they're doing, rather than the fact that there was an overemphasis on SEL because there had to be, because there was real damage going on with students. And students were literally losing people in their family, where they were literally burying their caregivers. So absolutely. And I don't think that we as a profession have talked about that aspect of it because they have us in such a defensive position. And, you know, it became this, oh, I don't want my child on a Zoom when the teacher has a Black Lives Matter Zoom background. Just ridiculous stuff like that. And not even thinking about the other side of that screen and what they were revealing from their own homes on the other side of that screen. But I think that in several of these folks' minds, they thought, well, that's normal. This is what's going on all the time. And my students aren't learning the basics or whatever. It's all this touchy-feely business. And I don't like it. And what's happened to kids? And so, you know, part of me agrees with you, Rod. And another part of me wonders how much the Zoomification of pandemic learning pushed that forward.
No, I think the point that you made before, which is on the whole, if you thicken the relationships between parents and teachers and help them see what you're doing in the classroom and maybe why, in the case of what you just said, all sorts of, you know, misapprehensions emerge in the absence of information. Shin, I was just having lunch with one of our research doctoral students, and she said she was having a conversation with one of our practice-based doctoral students, and the practice-based doctoral student said that he was very jealous of her because the research doctoral students get twice as much funding as the practice ones. And she said, oh, that's interesting. I always thought that the practice ones got twice as much as we got. So in the absence of information and conversations, lots of bad things sprout. And in the presence of those conversations, you know, much better things happen. And then relatedly, like my experience with teachers is that teachers are teachers. Like they do not set out, teachers are not for the most part political activists. They do not set out to brainwash children in one direction or another. They, you know, either they're just following the pacing guides and trying to get through the material, or they're trying to teach kids how to think about things. So that leads to kind of a pedagogical question, Shin. I wonder if you could put your teacher hat back on because you were a teacher for a long time. How do you handle issues in the classroom where there might be political differences among the students, but the positions held by some of the students on gay rights or immigration or whatever it might be sort of feel actively threatening to other students because they have those identities? How does one handle situations like that pedagogically?
I think the way to not do it is the position that so many people are taking, which is just don't ever talk about it. Because exactly to your point, it's in the absence of information, in the absence of conversation too. I mean, conversation is our main technology. That's the one that's never going to break down, you hope. For me and my experience at this, I mean, just speaking for me and teachers that I've collaborated with, it is a lot like what you do in your classes, Jahl. It's a lot about norming and having folks agree to those norms, with kids, you're having to do a lot of, you know, fishbowl and modeling, and sometimes just stopping a conversation and saying, we're not where we need to be yet. I had students, you know, back in 2010, 2011, wanting to talk about race. They specifically want to talk about race and gender. And, you know, I'll look back at that now and think, wow, they were harbingers. But there were several times I had to just stop the conversation and say, no, we're not where we need to be yet. We will pick this up another time. We'll try it again. And now we're going to debrief it on paper and we're going to, you know, set some goals for how we're going to learn how to do this. It, because I do think that we forget sometimes that these are all skills that can be learned and can be practiced. And it's something that we as adults have gotten away from because we're encouraged to be outraged all the time just for profit. That's the difficulty, is teaching students in an environment where outrage is incentivized in some form or fashion and monetized. How do you learn how to have these conversational relationships with each other and talk about your experience and then be able to listen to somebody else's experience?
Keep the humanity in the conversation, right? I know when I was teaching sort of middle school years up in Northern Canada, North Central Canada, where logging industry was huge. And the eco movement was really, really starting to pick up. And, you know, folks were spiking trees and, you know, doing those kinds of things. And half your class would be truck loggers or, you know, folks working in the industry. And the other half were folks that were working for environmental organizations. And it took a while to get to the level of trust that you're describing, to be able to sort of have some conversations that it's not about right or wrong or good or bad. Your dad's bad because he's a, you know, he cuts down trees, and your dad's bad because he's an environmentalist. To get to a place that we can have a conversation amongst and between people and humans and talk about the issues, which isn't the actual loggers that are involved or the, you know, it's what do we think about our planet, and get to some of those bigger ideas. But yeah, super challenging, and lots of pressure from community to land on an answer. What's the right answer? Who's good and who's bad? Well, it's not about that. And I think same in this case, right? It's not that clear cut.
I mean, I think, Shannon, the very first thing you said about building norms and the kind of classroom community you're trying to build is also critical. I mean, at Harvard, we have less ideological diversity than you have in Texas, I think, unless it's just opposite ideologies. But I think what I've seen some good teachers do is develop some norms of how we're going to treat one another, and that, you know, we're doing a thing together, which involves value and belonging and including everyone. And so as such, some things like you can have a position about whether you think, you know, at the Supreme Court, someone should be able to refuse to make a cake for a gay couple. Like, you can hold that position in a class, but you have to respect the humanity of the person who is gay sitting right in front of you. There have to be some shared norms and values that aren't up for discussion.
Absolutely. And I think that is a matter of you as a teacher. This is where you have to be very clear on your own values, you know, in the way that we colloquially always put it in my schools was, you know, what's the hill you're going to die on? And for me, I would let my students know the first day of school, like, the hill I will die on is everybody being treated like a human being in this classroom, because the world is mean enough outside this door. And can't we have one space where we can try to keep it from being mean and ugly and harsh and scary and all of that? And we can if we build it. And if we see it as none of us have reached where we're supposed to be, me included, how can we stay in conversation with each other? To the point of, I mean, and when I say skills, I'm saying very literally, in conversations I've been in with adults recently, I've wished I've had this. But when we would do Socratic discussions, Socratic circles, one of the jobs that students could take on was to sit with a little handheld whiteboard and make a hash mark under everybody who spoke and draw lines to who was speaking to who, so they could literally, concretely, visually see who was sucking up all the oxygen and who was being left out.
Jahl, through this conversation, it seemed pretty bleak. And I don't want to downplay those, but is there anything that's giving you hope? Is there anything that's sort of helping us see the path through this?
So I have kind of a historical bent and tend to see things as, you know, the present time is just sort of a slice of what's been happening over a longer period of time. And so if we just look at the last 10 years, you know, Trump and other populists around the world have surfaced, as Heifetz would put it, a lot of unhappiness on the part of particularly white folks and people in racially dominant, but often class non-dominant places. And I think the way that that's come to the fore has been pretty destructive, but it was also a signal that there were a lot of people whose underlying feelings weren't being, you know, heard. And then conversely, the things around that started with Trayvon Martin and ran through George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and all sorts of other horrible killings of African Americans by the state have really brought to the fore a kind of racial reckoning and a desire and a demand from people of color for sort of assertion of basic human rights, which also seems good. And, you know, those things have collided in really spectacular fashion. And so I guess to me, the sort of hopeful part is, okay, now we can see that there's a lot of stuff that was there before that was just under the surface that's really important to people. And so now it's come out. And so now the question is, like, how are we going to manage and deal and live with one another in a constructive way? And so I think folks like Shanna are giving us models of how you can do that. And there are lots of other people out there as well. And so I just sort of think we're like at the, what I hope is sort of the beginning, and that where we will head will be more constructive than where we are now. So that's kind of a long answer, but that's my thought.
I love that answer, Jahl. And it makes me think about, just in general, you know, the difference between hope and optimism. And I think it's really easy to confuse the two. And I always think about, you know, Vaclav Havel's like differentiation of those two things, which is, you know, hope is that you believe that it was worth doing, regardless of whether it was ever successful or, you know, met any metric or anything like that, it was worth doing. What's made me hopeful is that, considering the tsunami of pressures and pain and everything that COVID and all of the other terrible things that have happened in our society coalesce into this giant wave that hit schools, schools are still standing. Now they're having issues. Burnout is real all across the board at all levels, but we're still standing. And that, to me, is pretty amazing. The folks who, like my students, are all an administrator of some kind. The fact that those folks suit up and show up, regardless, that's what gives me hope. You know, I come to this campus and I see that our parking lots are full. And I'm like, okay, that people still believe in the hope of education. Not necessarily optimism or the outcomes on the other side of it, but they believe it's worth doing and showing up here as a student, as a professor, as a upper administrator, all the way down into like the Head Start teachers here in Amarillo. you know, who are passing out crayons and everything and teaching students that their voice matters by leading them through like a little midterm vote exercise. And that those are the things that give me hope across the board.
And Rod, what about you? What gives you hope?
Several things, but I think I'll focus on the kids. And I'm thinking more of sort of a couple of recent experiences with groups of high school kids, but also, you know, kids in post-secondary and young people that have, you know, in the world of work and so on, that are, you know, high school kids that are not fighting other people's agendas. So, you know, a typical school agenda or, you know, but they're saying, you get to keep doing that, I suppose, because you're the teacher or you're the principal and or the superintendent and you keep doing it that way. That's fine, but we're going to have this conversation over here. These are the things that we really think are important. And this is where we want to spend our time and energy. You can join us if you like. We would love it if you did, but we're going to do what we want to do around equality and equity, around students in a school coming to the conclusion that many of the teachers don't really understand how an IEP works for a student. And these aren't students with IEPs necessarily, and then advocating and saying, we're going to come and start educating teachers on that. We're just going to take that on. Recent groups of students that seem to be coalescing around consent. And there's just not enough consent education. And one group of students saying, if you think, a PE teacher putting a condom on a banana is what we actually need more of, you're wrong. We need to talk about consent, and that's what we're going to talk about. And just taking the agenda over, in a sense. And they're not doing protests. They're not, doing any of that stuff. They're just taking over the agenda and saying, this is what we're going to do. And that gives me hope.
All right. Maybe we should stop there. No lightning round today. I do want to thank Shanna for joining us today, as always. So incisive and to the point. Thank you so much for joining us, Shanna.
Thanks, Shanna.
Thank you.
This is Rod Allen.
And this is John Maida.
And this is Free Range Humans, a place where we consider how to make schools fit for human consumption. Today, our guest has been Shanna Peoples. Cheers, everyone.